Salutations and hello. We are back on the Science Nights. I'm Josh.
I'm Adam.
And we are joined today by Miles Greb.
Thanks for having me, guys.
What's up, sir? I met Miles back with Comics Brew. We did some interviews for his comics after the Gold Rush and Clovis. He's our resident expert on science fiction and comics.
Yeah, sure.
Totally putting that one on you right away.
I do the best I can to know the little that I do.
Today we want to discuss science in fiction. Not just science fiction, but science in general across all types of fiction. Today's culture is very much centered around what's new and hip, and not just what's new and hip, but also what the media is feeding, and comic books are one of those mediums. So we want to discuss today the role of science as it pertains to fiction. So first of all, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So, you know, my name's Miles Greb, and I live up here in Seattle. I'm a local comic writer, and I was the organizer for the March for Science in Seattle and and nationally as well. Kind of my main thing is that I try to make hard science-based comic books that deal with a more optimistic look at science because, you know, thankfully the scientific method works, and it actually does illuminate things about the world. And with that information, we've made the world a better place. And I think, unfortunately, science is often seen as a scary and unpredictable kind of...
It's too high level for me or something like that.
Sure. It's almost like serpentine sometimes. Like, it's sneaky and
it's dastardly. It's dangerous.
It comes up and bites you, right? I mean, that's Mary Shelley invented science fiction. She did a wonderful job. But the problem was its foundation was, you know, the doctor.
A little bit of a horror.
Yeah. The doctor plays God and it goes wrong. And you see that in Jurassic Park or most zombie movies. And it's true that the findings of science can be dangerous. You can see that in Fukushima, obviously.
Yeah.
However, you can see what plastics or pharmaceuticals have done for the world. Billions of lives have been saved. The Green Revolution saved literally a billion lives thanks to advancements in agriculture. And so, you know, for every example you can point to where there was a negative, you can just find this overwhelming, like, crushing amount of positive examples. And so I think it's really unfortunate that we focus on the dreariness and not what's uplifting about science.
So that's currently kind of the trend in a lot of fiction, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can name any number of future-looking fiction stories from Universal Soldier all the way through Time Cop and everything, like, in between.
I don't think I've seen Time Cop.
Jean-Claude Van Damme, he goes through the, like, back in time into the future.
I know Bloodsport.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
It's just bleak, right? It's bleak. We're always, like, it's never a good thing. And there's only, like, one difference in there, and that's Star Trek.
Yeah, that's, like, the one example.
It's, like, the
right?
one example where, like, society actually progresses further. Like, we lose money. We, like, we don't have a economy anymore. We all have, and we all do what we love and prosper.
Yeah, they're a communist secular society.
Sure.
Yeah.
I never actually put a name on it.
Sure. I mean, like, you could call them some other kind of different paradigm, but, you know, they don't have money, and everything is ran by the state.
Oh, right. Yeah, sure.
So,
and there's no God.
Yeah, well, so, it's like
no
that,
like major religion.
It's actually like that in all things. Just some people don't realize.
So I guess, why do you think the state of fiction is as it is?
I think a lot of it was the Cold War.
Oh yeah, that's a pretty bleak time.
I think another part of it is that the last time science fiction was kind of more utopian and forward facing, it was also extremely white and male centric and kind of colonialistic. Is about people going out into space and colonizing, but those people were really just one kind of people. So I think that left a lot of people behind. And then, like, you have the Cold War and different cultural changes in America that were kind of dreary, and so you kind of lost that tradition. And unfortunately, it was never picked up again. And so I think that we need to work hard to do that now, and do that with more different kinds of stories and more different kinds of people.
Had you ever, before reading After the Gold Rush and Clovis, had you ever thought about science fiction as this kind of dispassionate and bleak-looking future? Or I never even thought about, like, how most things are like that until I read his comic.
I've thought about it before, I guess, because there's, like you were saying before, there's lots of dystopian type future stories and stuff like that. We Maze always expect AI to take over when AI is really just going to help us out.
Sure.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird that you don't see the trends until, like, you're knee-deep in them, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, look at most YA novels nowadays. They just have, like, a formula, and one of the parts of that formula is, like, the government breaks down in the future, and it's terrible for the majority of the population except a select teenage few that are special.
The chosen kids.
Yeah. So was you saying that your need or drive to put some more optimism into it, is that where After the Gold Rush came from?
Yeah, so for people that don't know my story After the Gold Rush, you know, it's kind of my counterweight to this kind of dross that's in science fiction. It tells the story of Scout, the last scientist. She was born on Titan, which is one of the satellites of Saturn. Mm-hmm. And she was on the Beagle 2 expedition, named after Darwin's, you know, Beagle expedition, of course. And their job was to kind of check the ability to stay on Titan for a while. And so she was the first child born there. She's supposed to be a bioengineer, you know, using bioengineering to make plants that could possibly survive in Titan's atmosphere. Something goes wrong with her family, though, and she's put in a cryo sleep. And eventually, she ends up going back to Earth in the year 2449. And she finds Earth, it's new paradigm. It's green, it's lush, it doesn't have the Star Trek high-tech kind of utopia she was raised expecting it to be. So there's a shift, but it's not post-apocalyptic, though. Something else has happened. And the story will show Scout, who's a biologist and a chemist, as she tries to reintroduce science to the world. So we get to see actually science building and changing things for the better. And I also think... what will hopefully make the story work is Scout is a skeptic, an atheist, and a scientist, but she's in a world that is filled with a lot of superstition and magical thinking, but she'll kind of be on uneven ground because, you know, atheists, for example, are normally used to winning arguments because they have more evidence, or scientists are used to winning arguments on, say, you know, hot topic issues like evolution because we have all this body of evidence, but, you know, Scout doesn't have a fossil record to point to like we would, and so she's going to have to actually use the method kind of actively to prove her points and not just the work of everybody else like
we learn in school.
I'm not a scientist, right? I'm an amateur scientist in the sense that I do my best to understand all this, you know, but I'm just a science communicator, so I have the work of others that I rely on. And, you know, all this work is peer-reviewed, it's open, you can see the data, it's not obfuscated, but, you know, I rely on the work of others. She won't have that
luxury.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like that's a good point. You're a science communicator. Another title I never thought to give you and should have.
I mean, whatever you want to call it, you know.
No, it is. And it's a like we've mentioned in our first episode, we're neither scientists either, and we're doing our best to communicate what we do know, and we do rely on other people just like you do. Why did you decide not to just destroy your society on Earth instead you built this scared or superstitious society?
So I have a great answer to this question that I can't give you because it's too much of a spoiler. But a less good answer is there was a trade.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't that...
Someone offered something.
Something was offered, and now you find it the way it is. You know, like the technology levels, like 18th century America, you know?
Yeah,
they have,
yeah,
like, the wooden churches, and it's a very agrarian culture. You know, they're farmers. They're very narrative-based. Certain books are very important to them. They're not any one theology, so don't expect Scout to just go up against Christians, you know, or Muslims. It's not the way it's going to go in this story. It's very different. But I can't talk about it too much because it's getting spoiled. Although in the third issue, which will almost be out by the time this podcast is done, it just finished up on Kickstarter. There's a religious trial Scout is involved in. So you can.
Oh, what? Yeah, okay, cool.
So you can see a bit more of that.
Like Crucible style?
You'll see.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't want
to
dig.
So yeah, in the first two issues, you know, you see her come back to Earth. She meets one of the inhabitants, you know.
Right.
It kind of slowly starts, but it's going to build up much more. And issue four, she'll meet the person who made the trade.
Okay, cool.
So that's kind of the big buildup of the plot.
You heard it here first, guys.
Yeah. And if people want to check that out, by the way, afterthegoldrush.space is my website.
Right, right there.
Yeah, yeah. Somewhere. And at Gold Rush Comic is my Twitter, so you guys can check that out.
Absolutely. Now, there's a couple things that I find intriguing about it, about the not just the first issue of After the Gold Rush, but the second one, and it's your inclusion of Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm.
You have a full page of just the pale blue dot, which is a great artistic replication of the original image. And we've got it here on video for our viewers.
Yeah, Michael Shepard, the colorist, actually did that.
Yeah, that's a great page. Why did you not do the typical thing and continue the speech? I know he says he never says a pale blue dot, or he does, and then he's got more.
So I have my own little thing there by doing the next couple pages, right? Where I want After the Gold Rush to feel like it's actually our reality just in the future. So I think it's important to ground some realistic quotes from actual scientists in it, the way that Scout also references scientists like Mary Anning, mm-hmm. for example, in the first issue. I also wanted to start with it on a pale blue dot out of respect for, you know, Granddaddy Sagan, because I think he is the genesis of the modern science community tradition. He's also a big inspiration for me. I didn't want to go through the whole plot, the whole thing, because that the response to the things he said will be going on throughout the series.
Okay.
So like it's kind of like a motif of the themes that are in that speech, the famous pale blue dot speech.
Yeah.
And so I don't think I need to spell them out for everyone. I think that they can
your
see
audience
them.
Is a little smarter than that.
I hope so. But you know, buy it even if you're not that smart, that's fine. As long as you buy it, that's really my concern. I mean, because there's a Carl Sagan quote in the second issue as well.
Yeah.
There's also an Asimov quote in the first one.
There is. The second quote, which is up on the video now, is it's from the same pale blue dot speech, but it says there's no evidence that someone will come from without to save us from ourselves. Why that quote particular?
Well, it both kind of brings up like a counter mythology to what Scout is doing. It also, of course, speaks to the counter of the religious idea, you know, that there is a separate narrative. Basically, religion says that there is a counter narrative to the one that we see before us, and it's more important, and that it will either save or damn us eventually. You know, which is ridiculous. And also, like I said, the society is really narrative based, so it kind of breaks against that too. So, I mean, we almost put that quote in the first issue because I think that quote really sums up what's going on in the plot a lot.
Yeah.
But the Asimov line I thought was more important. So
in the world of science fiction, actually, I want to ask Adam this one first. Do you have any favorites in the world of science fiction, Adam? Like any favorite movies or favorite television shows or favorite writers or artists?
Quite a few. I mean, I guess movies recently would be like The Martian or Interstellar or something along those lines.
Arrival, you said, was
You kind of touched on a little earlier. Like one of the reasons why I like Star Trek is like the different view of science and the, you know, how their world is and stuff like that.
What about you, Miles, as far as science fiction writers and creators and artists?
I did like The Martian. I did not like Interstellar.
Not at all?
I think that it betrayed itself pretty deeply with the love powers maneuver that they went through.
Yeah.
Because
what is that?
So basically, they leave the galaxy, which I don't think that's a really reasonable solution. But that's what they do. And they go to a different solar system. And he communicates with his daughter through space after going through a black hole with the power of love. And like they get relativity quite correct. So like they try to do some of the science right, which was cool, but then they end it with love powers, and I feel like that's just stupid.
Well, it's cheating it, right? It's skirting the issue.
Yeah, and it just it betrays the film to me.
I like I said, I haven't seen it, so I don't really have the opinion on it. Why do you like it so much?
I just like it. I don't know. It's a good movie. I
people
like how
Christopher Nolan.
Yeah,
the,
it's true.
How they deal with relativity and like the one planet they're on, like that water one,
Waterworld.
Where
nothing's free in Waterworld.
I forget how much time is passing I'm pretty sure they say it in the movie, but it basically, like, you know, for every minute they're down there or whatever, it's like
an hour or something, or like year that. Or yeah.
I also don't like Anne Hathaway's character because she doesn't act like a scientist. She's very irrational and emotional and does things based upon her relationships and not her logic. And
it's Matthew McConaughey is the main in that, right? Or who's the main? Yeah. So it does he conform to the norms of or what you would expect out of a astrofaring person?
He's just a pilot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of different people can be scientists. There's no one stereotype. Sure. You know, we should be careful with that. That's a good idea. That's but good point. I mean, nobody in that movie acts really like a scientist, I'd say. I forget the guy's name, unfortunately. The black guy, I think, is probably the best.
The one that gets stuck up there for a while and is, like, older.
Yeah, I forget his name, unfortunately. But I think he probably was the best. Also, they're just ridiculous things. Like, they land on the water planet and the wave starts coming and they just, like, take forever to leave and get their shit ready. And it's just extra drama for no reason.
Yeah.
And I also don't buy the premise of the film that... So, basically, they're growing pretty much just corn.
On
Earth. Yeah, and they can't grow much else, you know. But... And so they keep growing corn. I mean, the movie never really brings up bioengineering in a relevant way as a solution to that. And I also don't buy that there's not any kind of biosphere or honor solution that's going to be easier than going interstellar.
Yeah,
because
for
I mean,
sure.
So regardless of how difficult it may be to cultivate on Earth, right? And it could become quite bad, especially with, you know, climate change, etc. You still have proper gravity that we evolved into. You do have an atmosphere, even if it weakens. You have, you know, less radiation. You have moderate temperatures, even if they suck.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're a good place away from the sun. You have a cycle that your body knows.
You still have liquid water. I mean,
I mean, like, all these things are massive advantages that you're not likely to get on another planet. And the let's just jump to another planet real quick plan seems ridiculous to me.
So is that a problem with modern science fiction? Is that, like, they claim to be scientific, but they don't actually take the bigger picture look at it?
I think it's totally okay to have kind of an outlandish things in your story,
sure, of
right?
Of course, yeah.
It's not bad. It's just that I think you can tell stories with actual science and have them be just as good. And it's totally fine to have a mix of that. You know, it's okay to have...
The Martian was a good example, right?
Yeah, the Martian's pretty good, you know? There's things here or there. But
like the dust storm. It would never have actually...
Yeah, the dust storm's bullshit.
Yeah.
Or in the movie, the Iron Man joke, like, that's
sure.
part's bullshit.
Sure.
That's on the book. But that's fine, though, right? That's a science-based film. It is. And it was a good story, right? People enjoyed it. Not everything needs to be, like, Independence Day or not Independence Day. We can have a mix between the Martian and Independence Day. That's fine. My point is just that we pretty much just have either aliens blow shit up or somebody in bioengineering screws something up and kills everybody. And, you know, that's just not really a great representation of all this work that we're doing.
For sure.
Ironically, you can see the work of all these scientists and engineers who build the technology to make those films. You know, in the films, right?
Yeah, like, exactly. That's a good point.
Yeah. I especially get upset about the bioengineering stuff just because, you know, GM technology is so important and can help so many people, but we just besmirch it, like, ad nauseum in all these films.
Well, yeah, it's not just that, like, it should be homegrown and organic and stuff. Well, like,
organic's, first of all, organic's total bullshit.
Yeah, it's a complete
marketing scam. First of all,
but it's gluten-free.
Organic is a damn science term, right? It's a biology term.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a non-organic apple.
Right.
Like, that doesn't make sense. Organic refers to a kind of chemistry.
Yeah, it's carbon.
It's carbon-based chemistry, you know, the other stuff. But it's a kind of biological machine, right? Mm-hmm. And they have turned it into an advertising term. That basically means a certain kind of arbitrary standard for growing. The arbitrary standard for growing wasn't based on sustainability. It wasn't based on health. It's based on wholesomeness.
Yeah.
And so they're
which
actually
is a
making
really abstract term.
Yeah, they're making like this idea of wholesomeness or like better food. And by better, they mean you think it's better.
Yeah.
Right.
As opposed to maybe actual nutrition value or cost of raising or whatever.
Yeah. And so they make that a opponent of science. Yeah. You know, because like, they're like, oh, well, look at this GM corn. We don't like that because our corn was grown on a farmer farm and the farmer wears overalls, so therefore it's better. And I mean, it's really sad because, like I said earlier, you know, like with Norman Borwick and the Green Revolution, it saved a billion lives. A lot of those were like in India. You know, a lot of people in developing nations, although Indians are a great nation, been around a long time, they don't have this a lot of the establishment that we have here in America. I mean, those lives not matter. Like, I mean,
they're not American lives, man. I mean, just saying.
And in America, you know, we can grow food more sustainably with GM technology because we can spray less, we can use less water, we till less, and tilling reduces carbon. But for some reason, this is demonized all the time. And I can't tell you 100%. Movies like Jurassic Park make this happen. but they certainly don't help.
Yeah.
Because people make those examples like, oh, well, you can't trust scientists. What if this gets out in the wild? You never know. They're gonna fucking kill Newman.
Yeah.
Right?
or like they're fighting a new bacteria. Like the second Mission Impossible. How about that? Where like he infects himself with a virus and like he's got to dose him or whatever. It's going to go catastrophic worldwide. Yeah. And this is just some guy that was working in a lab, like, and like a CDC lab, essentially.
Sure.
And it's catastrophic if it gets out there. But like, is he really, is that really the message you want to send? I think you're just, like you said, you're trying to scare it.
Yeah. Or, I mean, they don't think about this stuff. People aren't thinking like, oh, I mean, some people probably do, but the majority of these films don't do that. It's just, science is complicated and therefore a little mysterious and therefore a little bit in the bushes. And if there's a rustle in the bush, people think it's a tiger. And so they go, oh, I don't know what this is. You know, this science shit's going to get us. And this is not good. I don't like it.
So what about science or, you know, the greater sciences? What excites you about those? Like in the realm of all the different studies of science other than astronomy, because I imagine you're huge on that one. What is
biology is my favorite, probably.
Yeah.
Is it
kind of where Clovis is coming from?
So Clovis is anthropology, I guess. Okay. Yeah. Mostly. I mean, so the megafauna are awesome that you see, you know. So Clovis is a story I did about the Pleistocene era. It's set in 1200 BCE. Follows a young mother looking for a lost son. The Clovis people were the predecessors to what we would call Native Americans. They were here in early North America. And so they live side by side with like megatherium, who used to live up here. We have one in the Brick Museum.
Where's that at?
It's in Seattle by UW. And, you know, they were these 14 or more foot tall giant sloths. And,
talking about those cute, cuddly little ones that paddle, right? Those kind of sloths?
No, they're a lot larger than that. Yeah. A little bit different frame, but they're still very cute. And, you know, we had horses and camel in North America, all kinds of different animals that are now extinct. And, you know, I've always had a fascination with them since I was little, and just kind of the way that the ecology was different when they lived here. But also the anthropology and just the interestingness of how humans moved around. So the Clovis kind of are like really cool to me in that way.
Yeah, for sure.
Because like, you know, humans come from Africa. They come from Africa. And then, you know, some moved over to Asia a little bit. And then there was the major migration from Africa up to, you know, the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
Then you had another group of people from Mesopotamia that went up north. And that's where you get the lighter skinned people, because they met the Neanderthals who moved up a while ago.
Yep.
And most likely they bred, and that made them a little bit more fair as well, because the Neanderthals were more adapted to the conditions up north, which are colder.
I read a statistic that said something like 6% of Europeans can trace Neanderthal DNA still into their genes.
All humans, except for a certain South African subset, have Neanderthal DNA.
Really?
Yeah, all humans do. So the only humans that are really like non-Neanderthal are this very small subset in like lower Africa.
So you know how that happens? Sex.
Yes.
Lots of we fought like
Homo sapiens reproduce sexually. That's correct.
No, but like with Neanderthals. So it's technically cross species, isn't it?
So species is a debated mushy word in biology. Sometimes it means things that can mate are the same species. We're in the same family as Neanderthal.
which is the homo part.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I mean, we're, you know, we can do it. it also maybe, by the way, so you know, you have Australopithecus or the Hobbits.
Oh, okay.
All these other versions of our past, right? It may be that we're much closer related than it seems, because there's just a lot of morphological differences that were very small genetic differences. So we're still building this picture. It's still a very active process. And I just always find that anthropology interesting. And like I said, I wanted to tell a story about how cool humanity's past was. And so it's kind of part of Clovis, you know?
Sure, of course.
Sense, like, I hope that people will view these kind of science stories and get inspired by them. I mean, that's kind of what we always done. I mean, like Jack Kirby, you know, wrote a bunch of stuff about what he thought was science, like ancient astronaut bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Chariot of the Gods inspires tons of science fiction, or worst movie ever candidate, Prometheus, is, you know, Chariot of the Gods bullshit. Because so those people thought they were doing what I'm recommending, but they weren't, you know, because they were looking at pseudoscience.
Yeah.
So I hope people look at actual science instead.
Is there a Adam, is there a study of science that, other than astronomy, that you'd like to see something fictionalized? Like someone does something really cool with chemistry? Or
I would have said chemistry. I'm surprised there's not something like that.
I got chemistry in After the Gold Rush.
Yeah, nice. Absolutely.
Yeah.
She makes penicillin.
Right.
That's awesome. I guess what I would say is, like, I would love to see a movie about geology that isn't about how the Earth is going to cool down or explode.
The core.
Based on how hot the core is. Like, yeah. I'd like to see geology used in a movie where it actually is, I don't know, sexy, but I don't really know how to do that other than, like, it's an avalanche.
You can always do something. So, like, in Fantasia, they do the whole kind of evolution thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can always do kind of, like, a short abstract piece like that, where you show the layers being formed over time, and like kind of like the violence of plate tectonics, you know, and like the layers themselves will become characters. They're squished and moved, and you can see, like,
talk to each other.
Well, yeah, you can see minerals that were once in the area of the globe what we'd call Asia, you know, move down and slip here, and then they come up one day in America, you know, and like that could be cool.
You totally see, like, so they're the characters that are there for the whole movie, right? And as the strata form, new characters show up.
Pretty much,
but
yeah.
The lower characters that are creating fossil fuels, essentially, right? What you got down there? I had dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Now I got some coal, now I got oil.
Well, it's not just, you know, it's all the plants too. The plants make more dinosaurs, but yeah.
I got
you though.
Damn it!
I'm sorry.
Often wrong.
Popular misconception.
Often wrong. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. I mean, dinosaurs do make oil,
there's
kind
way
of
more plants.
But there's way more biomass for plants, like,
gotcha.
Not even close. So we're pretty much, it's extinct flora, not fauna, that we're burning.
It's one of the things I love, not only about doing science nights but also hanging out with Miles, is I never not learn something.
I'm sorry.
No, I always learn something new, and I'm usually wrong, and that's fine. That's the point.
I'm
of science,
wrong a lot,
right?
Too, when I hang out with science people. They fucking correct me, and I'm passing it on, you know.
See, it comes down. Like, eventually, we'll be at your level, and then we'll all be kismet. it's one of the tenets of science, though, is that, like, we'd like to be wrong so that we could then test another variable, right?
Yeah, well, that's how you get famous in science, right? You don't get famous in science by making up some new bullshit. You get famous in science because there was a paradigm and you demonstrated reliably and repeatedly that the paradigm didn't describe reality. And then they're like, hell yeah, man, good job. You know, that's how you get famous, which is good because it's a self-correcting mechanism. You know, it has a self-built-in criticism reward system, which really is the what you want to have in anything. And so it's important for scientists, you know, to be okay with being wrong. I mean, it's hard because we're humans, but
hubris gets in the way.
Sure, but if you can put a value in now you're right, though, you know, like every time you learned you're wrong, you also learned how to be right, as long as you have the humility. And so it's also kind of funny because in a lot of these shows, scientists have a lot of hubris.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
often.
Like, I mean, there's stupid shit like God's Not Dead, where they're just like fucking scientists, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, just even in like a modern thing like Jurassic Park, you know, like there's like, oh, these scientists, they, you know, they don't know what they're doing, and they before you even knew what you had, you know.
Malcolm,
so,
yeah.
Yeah.
If you read Michael Crichton's book, Ian Malcolm's way more critical of them than that. But at the same time, you see more of, like, the movie doesn't show, like, the Dr. Wu's side of it very much.
Yeah.
But in the in the book, you see that like he's like, oh, I never even thought about the repercussions of science. I was just doing it because I was getting paid, or I was doing it. Like they, Crichton paints him in a bad picture too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. which is always ridiculous because Mizdaw has ethical standards for doing scientific stuff,
mm-hmm. like, especially on living creatures.
Yeah, and it's funny too because people like bring up ethicalness, the efficacy of like animal testing, right?
On rats, but
there's
rodents,
really yeah. high ethics standards for testing on these things. And also, if there wasn't, you get bad results if you stress out your rats, for example,
mm-hmm.
And it'll mess up your study. So sure. people don't do that.
Because like, you're looking right. for behavioral changes, yeah. right? And the environment you keep these things
stressors,
in is definitely
yeah,
gonna
be a problem. Yeah.
Change the behavior.
Which, by the way, so like there's a famous anti-GMO paper by Seralini where he chose these rats specifically that grow mega tumors and then fed them GMOs, and then they grew mega tumors as expected. And then he didn't euthanize them or, you know, give them painkillers or anything.
He kept them alive.
He kept them alive and let the tumors continue to grow to Jesus. The grotesque versions that no working scientist should allow and is not wow. common practice. So he could take these pictures to say that GMOs cause tumors and cancers. Jesus. And it's like completely unethical. It's terrible yeah, science. It's and it's really dangerous.
It's cruel.
Yeah. yeah. and that's like shown as like a good positive thing. There was a group in town called March Against Monsanto. It was a big anti-GMO group, mm-hmm. but thanks to the March for Science, I think we kind of fucking stole their thunder, and there wasn't one this year. So,
yeah,
I'm pretty proud of that.
We're running long, but I want to get into the March for sure. Science. This happened around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And
also in space, the space station gave us a shout out. Yeah. So literally around yeah. the world.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. This happened June or May of 2017.
It was I should probably know. I tell the date. Wasn't it April 22nd?
Oh, okay. So I was way
might
off
have
again.
Been. Yeah.
I think I'm pretty sure it's April 22nd.
Year.
Yeah, it has been.
I should remember. I said the name on the radio like 1,000 times.
But I mean, take it away, man. Where did it come from? Why'd you do it?
Sure. So, you know, Trump got elected.
Yeah.
And uh-huh. He seems to not be favorable of science.
Well, no, he cut most of the EPA's budget.
Well,
and
he proposed the cut.
Okay. Excuse
you
me.
Know,
yeah.
He,
right.
And we actually deserve some good news on that. But he proposed basically just a clusterfuck of the EPA. He tried to censor publishing research on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
He shut down a bunch of people who work at our national parks from talking about climate-related issues.
I do remember there was a law passed last year before the election that was from Congress, and it was upfunding NASA's budget, and there were limits on what the administration could do
mm-hmm.
against curtailing that.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was like the law said, regardless of incoming president, like they knew what
yeah.
was going to happen.
Yeah, and just a silo of other
yeah.
Attacks on science. And then, of course, you know, he says things like climate change is a Chinese hoax. So there's rhetoric behind
yeah.
all this as well.
Yeah.
And then he put in a creationist climate change denier and head of the EPA,
wow.
Which was not good.
Well, yeah, and the Environmental Protection Agency, and he doesn't care about climate change.
Yeah, and he doesn't understand science,
right.
more importantly.
Yeah.
So he's unfit to do his job. And so Jonathan, who started the DC March, you know, got on Reddit, and he was like, you know, the Women's March was great. That was impactful. We should do one for science. And so the DC March just got started, and you know, I'm pretty active online all the time because I'm always talking about my comics and shit.
Of course, yeah.
And so I was there within like the first hour of this conversation, and so, you know, I was like, well, we should get the Seattle one started. And I figured I had a bunch of kind of like pro science art I could kind of like debrand from After the Gold Rush and just use to get a social media thing going.
For sure, yeah.
And so I got our Facebook started, I got the Twitter started, you know, I started a GoFundMe for us, you know, I got us a place to put the money. I got some I made a meme that went super popular with the Earth. I used the I'm with her but pointed to the Earth, you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
and
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I made that meme, and
nice.
Then that got crazy retweeted, most retweet thing I've ever made
that's
in my life.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was like 40 million.
Wow.
Sorry, 40,000
okay.
retweets.
One of my old professors had this theory. How long did it take you to make that meme?
I don't know, like a minute.
Yeah, right. So like he'd do this about journalism. He's like, I would spend weeks on a story for journalism and write like the best thing I've ever written, yeah. And I'd get like one or two responses. But then you do something stupid and quick, and it's like blows up.
Well, that's why you, by the way, talking about science, you should read The Selfish Gene, because you'll understand that there's like a real. It's mimetics, right? It's more selected for. It's a simpler organism. It replicates way faster.
Okay.
That's why like larger organisms like a megafauna, like I said about it earlier, won't have many children. It replicates really slow, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like bacteria or something a smaller, virus, germ, that's simple, yeah. Replicates really fucking fast.
Sure.
It's the same principle applies with this kind of ideas that works in biology.
Okay.
But anyway, so yeah, so we got started, and then I was looking for some people as the Facebook group was growing, you know, that I thought would be really good leaders. A couple of people reached out to me, and we got them in positions. One of them had resigned after some things. They were also a creationist. So, you know, we had some people that weren't the grass, but like Teresa Swanson, for example, who was the major co-organizer with me, she was wonderful and really helped with everything. And, yeah, we made some shirts, you know, I have one with Australopithecus on it. We have like a Adam and a whole bunch of shirts and sold thousands of those. So that was really cool. And, we got, a bunch of people to come to the actual march itself. You know, the governor was there. This fellow who just resigned angrily from the EPA was there. A bunch of local scientists and, you know, we had different students to come and talk to about their experience. And I think, so the march, you know, it wasn't so much a protest, but a celebration.
Of course,
obviously, yeah. It was a celebration in spite of actions that we were against. But, you know, we weren't just there to be against something. We were there to be for something.
Yeah,
because science,
sure,
is supposed to be a collective human process that should be for everyone. And so we wanted to show that everybody was out there to protect it and defend it. And that it's ridiculous that it would be partisan. I mean, what to do with scientific information could be reasonably partisan. To say, you know, some people think, well, the market will fix global warming. Some people say, no, you need invested federal plans to do it. You know, those are political arguments.
Yeah.
And we can have those arguments. If the greenhouse effect is a real thing, and if it is being increased by human activity, and if it is warming the globe, aren't political opinions. Those are scientific assessments
right,
that are demonstrated and replicated through the data that scientists all around the world of different other ideologies all agree with, because it's fucking real. And, you know, things like that don't need to be debated. And I also thought it was important just to have a big public moment for science. When does that happen?
Wow.
Never.
We don't do that.
No, never.
You know, we have all these holidays and all these events, but it's never yay science, which is the method that gives us all this shit, you know? And so,
and especially for a lot of us, the luxury to enjoy that thing. I mean, think about the Star Trek thing in your hand, your phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not available if not for the people that came before you making and doing science.
And I also think having a big public conversation about science is a really great way to kind of connect us as people, you know, because science is a methodology we discovered collectively, you know. The Greeks didn't discover science. They were philosophers, and they tried to figure out the world. The Romans didn't discover science. They developed that. And then you have the Islamic Golden Age. You know, they developed replication as a method of, hey, if we do an experiment, we know something, we need to replicate it. There's no science without that, right?
Most mathematics is from them, too.
Yeah, a lot of, I mean, without the
algebra.
Yeah. I mean, or our numerals are Arabic, right? So there's a major advancements in the Middle East. India had major advancements in engineering as well. Then you go to China, created the first encyclopedia, started
cataloging
all this chemistry information that we had. And all these things as are shared through all these cultures and make the science that we have. I mean, and then you have, you know, in Africa, Northern Egypt, of course, was a champion of this stuff for a long time. Now, none of them had science. You know, I'll say these were all proto-sciences. Science is much more modern. But this is the story of humans trying to figure out the noise of the universe for all these centuries. And it really, I think, binds us together and shows this universal way of figuring things out. And I think we need to celebrate that, because I think that's the best way to celebrate what it means to be human together.
See, I already want to watch the movie or read the book about what you just described. In the course of 2 minutes, you described relatively the scientific history of our entire species. as we just started to discover more and more about ourselves. And if that doesn't sound like an interesting story, then I think we need to change what we think is actually good in fiction.
That's what I'm saying. So why can't we tell stories about this stuff? So, absolutely. You know, like, there's no reason why it always has to be us fighting half elephant dragons, you know, and don't make the mistake. We need to fight them because they are coming. And I think that story should be told. I'm a nerd, man. You know, I love Final Fantasy. I love all kinds of nerd shit. And it's nothing against that stuff. But this other genre, this scientifically factual genre, needs to exist.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It needs to exist to celebrate humanity and the universe and the work that men and women do to make science, you know, a reality.
Absolutely. Well, before we go, please, so it's afterthegoldrush.space.
Yep, that's me. And so at Gold Rush Comics is my Twitter.
Yeah.
And you can, Google Miles, grab him on Instagram. I post all the cool art there. You can check out my books, you know, of After the Gold Rush, which I've talked about in Clovis. I also have two fantasy stories. Like I said, I have no problems with fantasy, but a webcomic called The Artist, which is on Tapas, you could check out, or my theology I wrote called Espers. I talk about science and shit, so you guys can Google me, check me out, and make sure you check out their other show, Comics Brews, too, because they've had me on there a couple times, and it's a fun show.
Before we go, I want to thank you first for giving me this idea of peer review. Miles does this excellent thing at the end of After the Gold Rush, and he asks for peer review on Clovis, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Clovis isn't going to, because it's a graphic novel, so it doesn't really work. But sure. After Gold Rush,
every issue of his book, at the end of it, he asks for peer review. If there's something in the science that he got wrong, please let him know and correct him with the proper way to do it. We want to invite that as well. If there's anything tonight or any other episode that we need to fix or that we are wrong with, please correct us.
I rambled a lot, so I'm pretty damn sure I said something wrong.
But yeah, science is a peer-reviewed process. And
yep.
It's better as we all, like Miles said, come together and fix it for ourselves.
Everybody makes mistakes sometimes.
Absolutely.
So.
I put my foot in my mouth at least four times this episode. It's been fantastic. But for this week of Science Nights, thank you so much, and we'll see you later.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.